co-directors of Emerge, and I'd like to welcome our esteemed panelists and our moderator, Todd Smith. Todd is the director of the Tampa Museum. He is currently actually organizing a mid-career survey of one of our fellow panelists' work, Janet Biggs, and he is a video art specialist. All of our panelists here today are here because of their strong connections, be they artists working with the medium of media video, or because of their commitment to educating the public about it and purchasing it and supporting the artists. So, Todd, thank you very much.
Again, thank you for coming out this afternoon. We're going to keep this extremely informal, so when you have questions, feel free to raise your hand and we'll take them as we go. This is meant to be an enjoyable hour, except for the five of us who are going to be grilled by the group here in the front. And our performances will be rated on degree of difficulties ranging from 2.0 to 7.7. And I just want to point out to Helen that it is the afternoon, not the morning. But, but I know how fair. All right, it's morning somewhere, and you're hoping for tomorrow morning, right? Again, congratulations on behalf of all of us on the fair success so far. As Helen said, my name is Todd Smith, Executive Director of the Tampa Museum of Art. And my job is a very simple one today, and that is to keep the conversation going. I have been intrigued by video art for over two decades now. And my first job years ago was in a small museum in Hickory, North Carolina. And it's a tiny blip on the map. And out of nowhere, I decided to invite John Hanhart to come to Hickory and give a day-long seminar on video art in 1989. And he actually agreed to come. So I got hooked very early on as to what this medium can do for audiences of art museums. And since then, I've tried to focus as much as I can as a curator and then director on bringing video art primarily to regional markets, which is a very intriguing and interesting prospect. I'm joined here by four amazing individuals who have also committed their lives to understanding video art and understanding this medium. And I'd like each of them to introduce themselves and then also give us one current direction that they see in video art, and we'll use their four comments as the launching off point for our discussion. So directly to my left is Anita, if you'll start.
Thank you so much for inviting me, girls. Yeah, it's very difficult from which point I should start. I collecting with my husband more as 35 years art, and then more as 10 years ago, I was falling in love by coincidence with video art. I saw a video piece, and I was so fascinated, I couldn't imagine that something will happen in a media what I didn't know. And I was really informed about art for more as 20 years in this time. Then I am a gallerist in Frankfurt, of course. This is what I have to say first. And I have now more as 10 years, the opportunity, much more as 10 years, to show every time, every show what we have with normal medias in the gallery, in the video space, additional video shows. And sometimes we have one artist who, if the artist is working in both in all the medias, then we show only one artist, or do we make confrontation between the normal media and video art? You ask me for the current direction in video art. I have to change my meaning every 4 months. I think 2 years ago I was thinking the moving image is history. We had this period, and just in this moment, the interest from the collectors grows up. Of course, we sold a lot of works in different museums all over the world from our video artists, and the video artists have, in case of shows, huge success all over the world. But it has nothing to do with the commercial side of this artist. You can sell it, but it's never enough that they have money to produce new works. And this is a very, very strange situation for the artist too. And in the last 2 years, I realized that the interest grows up also to have video works in the private collection. I think this has also to do with the technology what we have today. The flat screen, of course, it's not the nicest situation to present video art if an artist has made it, produced it as a projection, a big projection. But in the last years, the artists have really was rethinking and to make works what you really can show on the flat screen and what somebody can own in his house and can show in his house. And I have given a lecture 1 week ago, and I was really surprised in the Hamptons that people come and they had no connection to video art. Of course, they know it and they saw it in museums, but they have never watched a video from the beginning until the end. And I have made a selection mostly from animations, who has reference to drawing or the painting, whatever, and the people have to sit and they have to look 7 minutes or the 5 minutes from the beginning on the end. And then she was really surprised what they missed in the last years, because they went to the exhibition, they had a look, 5 seconds, and they passed away. Passed further. And after all this experience, you have always to change your mind and you have to speak to the artist and you have to react, whatever. And then the artist, they should now mention her own experience.
Great. Hi, my name is Jonathan Monahan, and I'm an artist working with 3D animation, and I make short films and video installations. I have a work in the video lounge next door. And I did my graduate studies right outside of D.C. at the University of Maryland. I just got my MFA in May. And since then, I've been kind of hopping around various artist residencies trying to make some new video work. And that's, a little bit of background about me. And I think, again, like Anita was saying, you ask about the current directions. It's hard to pinpoint a current direction because it's something that's really changing fast, and I think it's partly because of just new technologies. And I think whether it's YouTube or whether it's video editing technologies or computer graphics, all of that really affects the way artists think about video art and the moving image. And so, I can't pinpoint a current direction, but I think there's a lot of exciting things going on. And so, I think, there's a lot of artists doing really innovative things with it. So I think it's just something that we gotta, take a look at and, start enjoying more, I think. So, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Janet Biggs, and I am a video artist, although I honestly think of myself as an artist. First and foremost, and I work with Connor Contemporary as my gallery, Connor Contemporary Art, and I'm happy to be having a mid-career survey with the Tampa Museum of Art coming up, opening October 6th. I've been making primarily video installation works for about 15 years now, so I really sort of feel like a dinosaur in the field. When I first came to it, I really came to it because I had an idea and it seemed like the best way to realize that idea, not because I had any special affinity to the medium. But I still sort of think that I'm an idea-driven artist. It just happens that video keeps presenting sort of new ideas, the way to realize new ideas. So 15 years later, here I am. As far as a new direction, I actually think that that video has kind of comfortably settled into middle age, and I say that in the kindest possible way, that it's hit a point where it's no longer so exciting that it has to be obligatory, and there's one tucked in the back of every gallery, no matter what the strength of that artist is, if they work in another medium, and it's a stronger thing. They used to have to always do a video. I think it's kind of weeded itself out so that people that are working in video have a different kind of commitment to it, so that like Ryan Chikardin can work alongside of Isaac Julian, so you can have a YouTube influence next to vastly cinematic, which I think makes it a much more interesting time for video.
Hello, everyone. My name is Manuel de Santarén, and I am the collector at this in this group. I know all of these wonderful people. We have a connection somewhere along the way. I used to feel that I was a dinosaur in this medium of collecting because, you know, people would look at me and say, "Oh, you only? Oh my God, you collect video?" And that's pretty much all I collect at this point. It's the moving image, but I don't feel I'm alone anymore, which I don't like because I like being the big fish in the pond. No, I'm just kidding. It's actually great to find other people who are committed to, you know, to collecting the medium and displaying it, living with it. It's still nascent in some respects. I mean, there are still people who, you know, are, when you tell them, I collect video, they get scared. It's like, oh my God, how do you live with it? You know, the technology frightens me. And I tell them, well, it shouldn't frighten you because you have mobile phones, you've got laptops, you have flat screen TVs in your house. You live with technology. So it's how do you incorporate it into your everyday experience? As far as directions, there are many, but one that I'm particularly interested in is performance. I know it's not new, but there are a lot of, there's a group of artists working today who focus on documentation of their performances, whether it's repetitive or narrative. There's quite a bit of it out there. Some of it's great, some of it isn't. But there's great work being produced. And for me, it's very exciting because I get to participate as a patron and I'm constantly looking and pleasantly surprised.
I'm going to grab this if you guys will just keep that one. Okay. Yeah.
Do you count the non-ending kind of video as video art, driven by 3D game engines and such? Is that still video art, or is that different? The video I always think of as 20 minutes long, loop, whatever.
Well, that's a good question. I think it's a broad category, and I think there's this category of new media art, and oftentimes video gets lumped into that. Or is considered part of it. I guess maybe that's a whole other conversation, but I mean, I think anything that, you know, involves the moving image, I consider that video art, I think. That's my sort of personal definition. That might be different than others, but...
Well, Manuel, do you collect, what you collect is all a specific time, or is it a continual opportunity?
It's a continuum. Finite? Did you say, is it finite or?
Yeah, in that the work begins and ends.
Yes, most of it is that way. I do have a couple of, you know, new media pieces that you need to access via the web. Mm-hmm. That's an ongoing project. That are ongoing projects with no expiration date.
Okay.
But those kind of works are more in the conceptual arena. But I'm very much intrigued by that.
Okay. And Janet, your work has a beginning and an end.
Most of my work does have a beginning and an end, especially now. But I have to say I came to that reluctantly. I really used installation work where you'd walk in and experience it for yourself so that there was a kind of shared authorship with the audience. And I did that mainly because I think video art can be one of the most passive-aggressive mediums I've ever met in my life. And you know, when you sit there and you have to stay for the duration that someone else has established, if it has a beginning and an end, and you have the expectations that we all have come up with that are Hollywood expectations, and video art really often doesn't sit in there comfortably. So as you're waiting for the money shot, it's just not going to come more and more times than not. But when I say that now it's beginning and end and it's reluctant, it's I didn't want to participate in that kind of structure, but I got to a point where the thing that keeps me making work is when I challenge myself, and I thought if I can make one that doesn't bore me or bore my audience, then that's some place I want to explore.
And Jonathan, yours as well?
Yeah, I think that last point is, you know, I get bored easily, just like a lot of, you know, people. I have a short attention span, just like most people. And so, yeah, when I make my work, I want it to be exciting. I want people to, you know, I want people to stay for the beginning and the end. I want to make something that's, you know, worthy of people's 5 minutes, because, you know, that's something that's, somebody gives you 5 minutes of their time today. I think that's a pretty special thing. Yeah. I know that sounds bad and, you know, facetious, but that's how I like to think of it.
Anita, do you work with any artists that work outside of the confines of a time period, or are all of yours starting, middle, and end with the work?
We work with so many video artists. We have both parts. But the whole discussion reminds me really on the 35 years ago on the discussion about photography. Is photography an art piece, or what is it? I think 40 years ago, we have always had this discussion. I remember this very, as we bought the first photography, then everybody was like, what do you buy? The photographer can make 10 copies, 20 copies, you don't have this under control. And if we discuss today, I am on so many panels, we discuss all the time the same questions. And this feels me we are in a middle age, and the audience is now interested, of course. We work now more as 10 years with this media, and for us is it boring to talk all the time about this question, but the audience is now sensibilized? No, what is this in English? Klaus, help me.
Sensitized,
yes. About the medium, this is always shown. Now they start looking, but we are 10, 15 years or the 30 years in front of them. And I will not talk about the medium anymore. I will talk about art. And if you see all the videos, look, the different artists here, and look what we show. It's always a question, how can I visualize time? How can I talk about time? This is an artist here, make 5, 6 different videos, is talking about time. The next artist is talking about drawing, and it is in the video itself. I think the moving image is arrived in the contemporary art production. And we have not to speak about the medium itself. We have to speak about the art. What is the artist or the talking about? And we should forget, and it's not a question about the medium anymore. This is only the big disadvantage is that you cannot put a video art piece at home on your wall like you can put a painting on your wall. Klaus.
Well, it's good that you just mentioned that. I just wanted to go back to the question of what it is. I think it's important to a certain degree because moving images, so you have films, short films, feature films, you have films made on 35 millimeter, films shot of 16 millimeter, 8 millimeter, you have video shot on video cameras, HD, regular, whatnot. There's all these different formats. You have cell phones now. Because it's linked to the issue of integrity of the artwork that was brought up at yesterday's panel. If something is shot on film, can you show it on a video screen just because it's more convenient or it's more sellable and so forth? Where do you make the cut between a film that is considered film? MoMA has a department of film. It also has a video, department of video, whatever they call it. What do they call it? Yeah, they change it to new media, but it doesn't include anything that's shot on film. A lot of artists today do both. A lot of artists do short film, the 5-minute, 8-minute things that loop, but also 1 hour or longer.
So there's a lot of confusion, I think, and I think it's important to keep in mind. But again, I think the issue of integrity is really important to show things in the right format. If early video art was supposed to be shown, you know, on one of those one-channel or two-channel pieces, it shouldn't be projected, vice versa. So I think that's a very challenging and important issue.
Well, there is also like a new media art world, and that's kind of different from, I guess, what you could call the mainstream contemporary art world. And it has, what I mean by that is it has like its own institutions, it has its own galleries, it has its own departments and universities. And, you know, I'm not sure, maybe that's a problem, maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's going to change or something, but I think that's, you know, what you're talking about. It's sort of this classification can be kind of cumbersome for artists, and it can also kind of pigeonhole artists into making it a kind of work that that, you know, they get supported by the new media art world as opposed to the art world in general. Albert, do you have a...
Sorry, to bring the matter around.
Thank you. I'm sorry to talk about the medium, but I'm interested in, from the point of view of a practitioner in computer-generated video, whether for museums and collectors, the issues of dying media, like DVDs are about to be history, and I'm wondering whether museums and collectors need to, or feel the need to stash away duplicate old technologies, redundant systems that can play the work, or whether, again, addressing the previous point, there's a move toward transferring it to another way of displaying it, and I wonder what that does to the concept of authenticity in that.
You know, museums are already doing that. The Guggenheim has a conservator for new media only, and one of their jobs, very busy with, is to trying to locate Trinitron monitors, which are the only monitors that Marina Abramovich allows certain works to be shown. And of course, they're no longer being manufactured. So, and that they're buying slide projectors, Kodak slide projectors, are no longer being manufactured. So, they are at the point where they are not allowed to show these works if they're not presented in this specific, now outdated, no longer manufactured format. So I was really surprised to hear that, but there's a few, very few museums in the world now. There's one in Germany, too, and that do have these kind of multimedia conservators that are specializing in finding and repairing. They're repairing slide projectors now because they know there's only a limited amount left. So it's a big issue, a big problem. Sorry, I didn't want to...
to add to what you were saying, as a collector, it does become a bit of an issue, especially with early works. And I do have a couple of things that I've been stockpiling equipment. I find it on eBay, or if I'm driving in some little town and I see a TV repair shop, I'll hit the brakes and and go in and see if, you know, there's something there that I should buy, that I should have. The Tate has a very rigorous format that it's actually on their website. Regarding video art, which if you're a collector, I highly recommend you look at it because it tells you how to care for it, what the certain things that you should know, and it's been quite helpful. That information is now becoming sort of the Bible for a lot of institutions and certainly for collectors like myself. As the medium changes, and you know, and I'm buying works by contemporary artists who, on occasion, I get the opportunity to meet at art fairs or at, you know, gallery openings. I tend to pose the question: how do you see your work being preserved? And mind you, some of these artists are in their 20s, and the last thing that they're thinking about is their mortality. But you know, if you want your work preserved and you want it to continue 100-some-odd years from now, I think it's critical for artists to be open to the idea that this is a medium that needs to move to the next level, right, as equipment changes. 2 years ago, I was in Bill Viola's studio. I was visiting with him and his team, and they're in the process of upgrading over 3,000 hours of film. And the way that they're doing it is they go from the original format to what would be the next format that became available. Let's say if this is work from 30 years ago, then equipment from 15 years ago, and it's going on and on and up the ladder to current technology. And it's a monumental task. But he's undertaking it, and I think the Getty is partnering with him to do that, and they'll hold the archives to the work. It's a lot easier today to collect the work because it's either DVD format or it's a hard drive, and a lot of artists, certainly the ones that I collect, are pretty open to the idea of that it's they want the work to be preserved, not to become ephemeral.
But there is still a reluctance, and I speak on behalf of directors of regional art museums around the country and really actively collecting video just for that reason, is that we know that we don't have the capability to protect it and exhibit it after the next 5 or 10 years. So it really concerns us, if we invest heavily in it, that it's not going to be available for future audiences, which raises another question I want to talk about for the four of you is, what are some of the new trends in exhibition of video in galleries and in museums? I mean, there have been some great successes with new opportunities for exhibition, and there have been some sort of failures with how to incorporate video into a gallery space. So if you could just think back in your own opportunities to show and see work, what stands out as successes and what stands out as failures?
I think this is a tech. It's an medium who is working with technology, and technology is always growing up. And what Manuel was talking about, we have the same in Germany in the ZKM. And we have made also in Loop, we have made from the beginning on this video art fair symposium, and then was the ladies from the Tate, from the Guggenheim, from the MoMA, all was speaking about conservation. Of course, this is what you ask for. This is a big issue. But if you buy it in a gallery, this is our job to be in contact with the collector. And if something is changing in technology, if we sell a video piece, we sell it always with a Betacam. But today, if you produce in HD, you don't have a Betacam. You have a better file what you can use for the conservation. And if somebody has broken something or whatever, he has only to go in the lab and have to make a new copy, or we do it for them. We have all our video works, what we sold in VHS. Yeah, VHS. Can you imagine? We sold it without anything. I think we don't made a certificate. Yes, we have done it. It was really Wild West as he has started this. And now we have learned so many things, and now today to buy a video piece, it's completely safe if you're following up all the points what are written. It's a contract. It's not a written contract, but everybody knows this. It's the same with photography. If you bought the first piece by Andreas Gursky, you cannot look at on this piece anymore. It's completely yellow. You have to go back to the gallery, and you have to get a new print now today. This is the same. This is how it works, and this makes art alive.
I think that artist intent is really the sort of the final word here. That when a work is bought, I know that MoMA certainly does this when they acquire a piece from a video artist, or when they acquire a performance. They ask the artist if the artist is living. They really research and take copious notes and as much documentation of the artist's intent, how they want the work seen. And that way, when the work, the medium doesn't support it anymore because technology has become antiquated, that original technology, the curator can still present the work as close to the artist's intent as possible. And I think a lot of artists, you know, we've all said we don't want our works to die because the medium that it originally was fabricated on has died. And so I think a lot of artists are really willing to try and figure out how to perpetuate that work. And then there are artists that are very much sticklers for exactly how the piece has to be presented. I know that Christian Marclay's clock has a 23-page contract. Yeah, it's intense. and it's so intense that one museum that acquired the piece does not have, their museum doesn't have the facility to actually be able to display it, so it can't be shown there. So, you know, sometimes artist intent can work against them so that their work doesn't get out there. But I think ultimately artists want their work to get out there, and they're willing to work as, you know, to have that happen as the medium changes.
I it's the same idea. You know, I want people to see my work, number one. And then number two is, you know, controlling how you want it displayed and putting the effort into, you know, really that intent and making sure it's the best it can be. But of course, that's always a trade-off because you can't be at every install. Sometimes there's requirements and restrictions in the space and the installation, and so you can't always get that full control over how you want it to look. And that's unfortunate, but you know, it's a trade-off because you want people to see it. So that's I think just something we all have to deal with when we deal with this. So.
I wanted to address your question.
Thank you. It's a lonely chair.
It's okay. I'm with you. And I speak as a collector. Not, you know, I know that it can be a challenge for museums if they're having a video exhibition. The challenge I usually see there is the bleeding of sound from one work to the next, where eventually it can turn into this mess, into a cacophony that is very disruptive to the viewer. And, you know, I have ADD, so I'm like the perfect example of someone who walks in to look at a show, and if there's way too much noise, I can't deal with it. I have to go, which is unfortunate because you tend to miss out on certain things. And I don't know what the solution is for museums other than to build individual gallery spaces or black boxes to show that kind of work. And I'm sure museum budgets don't allow that anymore. As a collector, I have approximately, as of today, about 120 pieces in my collection of video. I don't have a house. I live in a loft, so I can't show it all. And so when I do show it, I basically curate what I'm going to show so that there are pieces that are silent. And my loft in Boston, I have 12 video monitors and a space that I leave for things that need to be projected or installation works. And so, you know, I tend to choose things so that at this end of the loft, there can be sound. Over here, it's silent. At this, you know, in my bathroom, I can have sound. In my bedroom, I can have sound. And that's how you do it. You know, you pick. You can't have it all at going on at once. And some pieces, you know, are, I actually never show. They end up being loaned to museums, and that's when I get to see them, and I go, oh wow, that's really great.
So since we're sitting here in an art fair, and video is, I think, one of the most difficult projects to show at an art fair, Anita, Lee, others who are in the gallery's business, help us understand what goes through your mind as you're bringing a video artist to an art fair and deciding if you're going to allow that much space and that much energy to go to a work that is sometimes more challenging, not content-wise, but from a spectatorship point of view, for the art fair goer.
This is so different. All the time, the experience is always different, and I'm very excited that the people here really take time and look and sit on the bed and watch the video. Perhaps this is an advantage now for this medium in such an art fair. Perhaps it can be. I think it is really important that you have the proper presentation of a video piece on an art fair, what you can do. Of course, we all use today the flat screen, and this is not the right media, but this is the only way how you can present a moving image and can give people an idea of the work. And if you come in a discussion with somebody who is interested, then you can show it has to look so, how the artist likes to present it, whatever. This is only an art fair is only an offering from something what you have and what they have looked very straight. But I had another point. Another point. What I like to say, I have to switch. I lost this. I have to say something more.
Okay. Well, keep it in mind.
Find it. It's very important. I have to find it again. I lost it. My English is so bad. I cannot talk like my mother language.
Well, I don't have any answers to that question because that's not my job. Yeah.
Do you mind commenting on art?
No.
I don't think it's fair to penalize a video artist because they don't make paintings. Okay, and so we like to take our artists to any art fair because your work can at least be seen, even if it's for 5 seconds and a collector has ADD, at least you've gotten a taste of that. But the same thing happens with paintings or prints or whatever. They run past them. It's red, I love it. I don't love it, it's not red. I mean, you know, it has blue, it has dogs, it's, you know, oh, it has kayak, I love it, you know, kind of thing. You're just looking for interest. You're looking for to gain interest in an artist's work. It's our job to follow up.
Yeah.
Bring it down to my level. I don't think the issue is time or duration of the video so much as for folks that are uninitiated like myself. It's the DIY, do-it-yourself, lo-fi characteristic and quality of the work. And we're so accustomed now to, you know, MTV and beautiful special effects in the cinema that we don't know how to absorb or read something that's so lo-fi. And do you have any, as experts, sort of advice for folks like me as to how to step into engage in a video like that?
Help us understand a little bit more, not to put you on the spot, but a little bit more about you. Where are you coming? Are you an artist or collector, or just
collector.
Just in interest in general, or?
Yeah, a collector, okay. Not an artist. How do we, not a lot of knowledge about video, how do we read something like a lo-fi video that may have some visual flaws, but maybe those are intended by the artist or not intended, I don't know. What are some of the things that we should know in terms of reading videos like that? Because I think that's the issue, not duration or medium.
Okay, that's a really good question, Thomas.
So as a collector, I can share this with you. The lo-fi thing has never been a hindrance for me. It's more of the subject matter. So, for instance, the first piece that I bought many years ago was relatively unknown, someone named Christian Markley. Big different story today, but he did a piece called Telephones. And he was basically appropriating clips from different movies. It was Hello and Goodbye. And they were, you know, the phone would ring, and they were a clip from, a Hitchcock film or so on and so forth. And if you look at this, it's kind of messy. I mean, it's not, you know, big, fluffy, flawless, you know, high resolution. But it had it was interesting because there were images that we have all seen, and I found myself going, oh, that's from Dial M for Murder, this is from this film, and that's what engaged me, not the quality of the piece itself, the technical quality, but it was the narrative and also the visual. So, you know, if I have any advice to you is let it touch you here and here first, And lastly, don't look at the production quality because it's probably intentional. In fact, I would say that 99% of the time it is. And there's some great stuff here, by the way, at the fair, like really, really good stuff to look at.
Again, from the point of view of a practitioner, what strikes me is that I think that the good art, which is the 99% that I think you're talking about, where the execution makes sense, even if it is lo-fi, I think from an artist should take into account what the presentation is going to look like. And most of the good stuff coming out of, say, artists working out of YouTube quality video, the good stuff takes into account not just how crappy it looks, but the fact that it's living on a network and all the other sort of levels that go into the technology that is going to be displaying it. So I would just say that for a collector, all these things should be looked at besides just the immediate, you know, how it hits you in the heart.
I found my point back about the technology. I have now, the end of the year, I will invite in Germany some of my colleagues from Germany in the gallery. There are two companies in Germany, and I'm sure you have it in America too. They produce glasses, and this glasses it has something on, don't ask me the technology, how they produced it. And if you can put this glass in a room like this, and you can project on this glass, and the video is so precise as you have it in an HD monitor. But the glasses is still very expensive. You have to pay in Germany for a size like this, what the painting is on the wall, 5,000-6,000 euro at the moment. But I am sure in 2 years or in 1 year, if more people is more famous, we can buy such kind of glasses. And the artists, I'm totally sure the artists find ways how they use this for her work, how they use this for her projection. And I was in an architecture office, and they showed me this in this office. I was totally surprised how this worked. And I think the technology will changing all the time, and we will have in 1 or 2 years very easy possibilities to show video art in your house.
Let's keep on technology. And Jonathan, okay. Since you're the youngest on the panel, thereby makes you the expert.
Right.
So talk to us as a group as to what we can look forward to, whether in your work or in others around
you. Sure. Well, you know, you talk about lo-fi. My work is kind of the opposite. You know, I'm like totally hi-fi in my stuff. I use high-end 3D computer animations technology to make my work. So it's kind of the same, many times the same exact software that is used to make like car commercials or Pixar movies. And I kind of like to think of my work as like a subverted Pixar movie sometimes. But you know, I got into that just because, like you said, I'm young, and so I was able to, when I was in high school, download illegally some of that software that Pixar uses, you know, and that's what got me into all this, was because, you know, I downloaded that stuff and I started using it, and I felt like really empowered by it because I had the ability at least to make like a Pixar movie, to make, you know, all this fun stuff you see on TV and in the movies. I had the ability to do that when I was like 16 in high school. And so, you know, that kind of, I think, is really empowering. It's also like really thrilling, you know, because so many people today have the power to like make something on their own that would have taken like a whole production team to make 10 years ago, you know, whether it's video editing software or computer graphics software or anything like that. I mean, big studios like would have, you know, you didn't have access to all the video editing software 10 years ago that you do today. So it's just, I'm not quite sure how that's going to change the video art. I'm not sure if it's how it's going to change the look of it. I think it's probably changing art in general more than maybe video art is. And I think, I think the computer technology affects artists who don't use the computer more so, I think. I think, you look at, in history, you look at, like, the Impressionists were influenced by, photography. Picasso was influenced by film. And I think that's happening today, too, a lot. I think the whole spectrum changes because of new technology. And so I'm not sure where it's going to take video art, but it's definitely affecting everything you see. So.
And Janet, any comments on technology from your aspect?
I've kind of been, when I first started making videos, I was, I had to have an outside editor. I used Namjoon Paik's editor, and I made laser discs. It was 16 millimeter. I mean, it was just really different technology. And again, I think that the technology is, access is exciting. The technology is sort of less exciting for me as it changes. Access and ease of realizing a project is what's interesting. And I agree, you can download things. You have a different kind of access now, which gives the artist a different kind of responsibility as well. When I get stuck in conversations about technology, I always feel like I would just so much rather be talking about content. Yeah. And so it's always, it's the thing that everyone comes back to, as Anita was saying, and it would be really nice to talk about.
I think that's happening, though. I think because it's so easy, that opens up more of a conversation about content because, now anybody could be a filmmaker, and so if you want to be talked about, if you want to do interesting stuff, you have to really make sure that the content is there and the quality is there. And that pushes, I think, the quality forward. So,
well, then in the last few minutes, if the two of you will continue but address now directions and content.
Right.
I think we've dealt with technology enough. Just briefly talk about directions in your own work and content and also where you see others around you moving.
Sure. I really think it's just unlimited, as much unlimited as any other medium. So I just saw the Ryan Chikardin show that was at PS1, and I have to say, when I walked in, I thought, I don't really want to do a YouTube thing. I'm going to go in and see this, but because I kind of have to, because he's getting so much attention, but I'm not sure I want to go there. And I have to say, it was really surprisingly compelling. The installation, I'm not a fan of people that use a lot of sculptural elements, like sort of house their video inside a sculpture. I think that editing it down to an essence is more important than framing it in some other way to disguise the fact that it's video. It usually doesn't work for me, and he made these environments that were incredible and gave the audience a different kind of access just in terms of their position in the installation. I mean, it was really, I was reluctantly excited by it because I'm much more drawn to the big and the cinematic, which is what I try and do in my work. And so that's usually where I go. But
the big and the cinematic is also a direction, too. It's not... I don't think that's, over or anything, and I don't think that's what YouTube aesthetic is going to be. Yeah, especially for you, yeah. I don't think the YouTube aesthetic is certainly, appearing, as in Ryan Chikardin's work, and it's certainly working in a lot of places, but I also think that big cinematic aesthetic, too, is also relevant and still interesting. And so, I think it's just, the artists are gonna take... As it becomes easier and easier to have more control over what you make, and I think the artists are going to just take that and run with it and are going to start, we don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what I'm going to be making in a year from now because, every time I make something new, I'm able to just, come up with, a new visual aesthetic, a new visual sort of texture to the work, and, that generates more ideas for me, and I think that's just beginning to get explored. I think so.
Yeah. I just wanted to add a little point to the sort of YouTube aesthetic conversation. And that, I mean, something that I'm excited about noticing is that the YouTube aesthetic keeps getting higher and higher resolution, right. And the Vimeo aesthetic is, right. Like, super hot HD. Right. And so that that particular look, I think, is changing so rapidly. And I think that adds a very particular content to the lo-fi that you were talking about, because more and more, that look is becoming something that is really a very, very purposeful choice, because it's really easy to work in HD now and even to post things online in HD.
I think there are, and for me, are many doubts in the moment, because we have so, so many requests every week to send the DVDs to festivals and to museum shows or whatever. There's really a kind of entertainment in industry, also in the video work. And this is what I really afraid about. I went to the short film festival in Oberhausen, and we had also a big discussion with curators from the Tate and wherever. And the question was, in general, where we can show the works of these artists from the festival the rest of the year all over the world. And then it was only, I think, mentioned 100 euros for the artist to show his work, which was produced the whole year. And this is a big problem now. If this work is everywhere available, who gives the artist the money for the real work and for the production in the future? This is really a big issue. And I have no idea how we can solve this problem if everything is available on the internet and everywhere. Of course, if you make a limited edition and you sell the certificate and whatever, people have an art piece. But the work has to be shown. This is a media, what has to be shown. And perhaps we find new possibilities to finance the production in the future. I'm really afraid how the artist should earn the money from, if this everything is so visible all the time in the world. There's no need to buy anything, because you can look it everywhere. What did you think as an artist?
Well, like I was saying before, I mean, I want people to see my work. That's the number one. That's why I make it, I guess. And so, you know, I put some of my work online, and it's not the best place for it. But if somebody in New Zealand or something wants to you know, see a short film I made, I mean, you know, I want to give that person access to it. But yeah, I think there are ways. Perhaps the collector here could touch on what he, you know.
I don't have an issue with the work being online, because what's happened for me over the years is that every so often, you know, when it's 3 a.m. and I can't sleep, and I'm, you know, either I'm Vimeo or YouTube or whichever, I've actually come across some really interesting work that has compelled me to do research, find out more about the artist, find out who represents the artist, and I've ended up buying quite a few pieces that way. So, you know, what you see on the internet and what ends up in your collection are basically, quality-wise, are two totally different things.
This is right.
So I don't think artists should be worried about, you know, somebody downloading a copy, you know, when if they're editioning their work and their gallerists are working diligently to place the works in good collections in institutions, you know, the integrity of the work won't be compromised.
Right.
We are running right up on 3:00, so any questions that we've not addressed from the...
I'm sorry. I really feel this is conversational. I want to thank you all for doing this. I think that one branch of video that might be sort of
better protected from this sort of distribution might be the algorithmic video that some artists are making completely synthetically, starting with the code and maybe whatever concepts they want to generate from. But that kind of thing, you're looking at the generated video, and it's always going to be changing based on whatever criteria that the artists have. So the code itself might be the piece that you sell, and that code can be protected.
Right.
Great point.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
Yeah.
Sorry. What, maybe we'll call the up there.
Can I ask about either the benefits or the problems with using video with also like a live element and how that affects either collecting it or preserving? Because there's a lot, I think now it's, is this too loaded of a question for almost 3 o'clock or?
You want to just give us a little more?
Well, I feel like there's a lot of people who produce video pieces and then interact with them live where it almost becomes where it's hard to call it, because it's more, I guess, than performance art, but there are things where it's a document of it later that becomes a video, and it's some, I feel sometimes it might be problematic to present it like that, or sometimes there's a lot of great benefits now with having videos ease be elements that are used either in performance art or even like big operas now they're using it, and how I guess it's, I just want to know if anyone has any opinions on,
I guess it's,
sorry. Okay. I can
take that one.
Last night I opened a piece that was a big performance, and it had synchronized kayaks in the East River of Manhattan along with a very large video screen and live musicians, and when the piece was coming together, all elements were realized and given equal weight. And I thought that the only way the piece would be successful is if every element was, you know, was as good as it could possibly be. It was documented, so there'll be a document of it. In terms of commerce, the video that I cut is not something that I'll do as a video to sell, because it was really specific to the performance, but it doesn't mean I won't use that footage in a future piece and cut it in a different way if I'm going to sell it as a single channel or as an installation. And I also think that there's the potential, you know, I mean, the Tate and MoMA, they collect performance. So I don't think those lines are so specific anymore. And I certainly don't want to be limited by anything.
In another answer is, if you look back to the painters, there are so many painters they make before they paint the main painting. They make studies as a drawing, they make sketches on a board or the whatever. And if you see today from Joseph Beuys, especially we have in Switzerland, this Thomas Huber, I think is not known in America, but he has... His work is always cutted it in many developing steps. First of all, he is making drawings. Later, he is painting big boards. And he's always considering about the background, behind the background and the surface. And if you see performance, it's a kind of document, and this is another kind of presentation later. You have the documentation of the performance, you have a real performance video, whatever. You can collect all the different steps. Or the video maker have also made, the video artist have also made stills from a video. It's also in relation to each other.
I always try, if there are stills of a performance, I always try to buy one or several. I mean, I started collecting photography originally, and some of the photographs that I have in my collection were performance, you know, documentation of performance, and that's way before video came into my universe. So, yeah, I think any material that helps to unify the work, whether they be notes or sketches, you know, clips, whatever's available, and if I can get my hands on it, I try to archive that work.
Well, please join me in thanking our panelists today who have done, I think, a great job.
Thank all of you. Wrapping up, there's a great 4 video rotations in the video lounge and throughout the entire fair. So go enjoy some video.